I was when I started studying this passage, I was like, Zophar is the coolest name. Why don't we have that name used anymore? It's so cool. And then I studied and studied, and I was like, oh, that's why. Because Zophar is speaking to Job, and if you just, well, for me, when I first read it, I was like, that is so beautiful. Like, how big God is and just how mysterious things are. And so don't give up no matter what you're going through because you just never know what the possibilities are. And isn't that sweet? And that's not at all what Zophar's saying. So sometimes it's better not to study or go too far into it because then you're like, oh man, Zophar, why did you mess this up? You could have been the coolest name in the 21st century. So let's read it together. Job chapter 11, 1 through 10. Then Zophar, the Naamathite, replied, "Are all these words to go unanswered? Is this talker to be vindicated? Will your idle talk reduce others to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock? You say to God, 'My beliefs are flawless, and I am pure in your sight.' Oh, how I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heavens above. What can you do? They are deeper than the depths below. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. If he comes along and confines you in prison and convenes a court, who can oppose him?" So I misread this letter. I kind of got stuck on that really beautiful piece. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heavens above. What can you do? They are deeper than the depths below. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. It helps to understand that what Zophar's motivation is in here, what his intention is to help. Because when you start to read the commentary and they're just like tearing him to shreds, you're like, wow, Zophar is a really bad person. But if you go back to chapter 1, first of all, you understand where Job is at. That Job has just experienced an enormous amount of trauma, like the most trauma that I think anyone in the history of the world has experienced. And I think that that's intentional in this story. It makes it so relatable, all of these horrible things that are happening. So if you remember this story, because I did not, and I had to have a refresher, one servant, so all of Job's adult children are at the eldest son's house, and they're eating and drinking wine, and Job's at home with his wife, and one servant comes to Job and says, "Your oxen and donkey are attacked by Sabian. They also killed the servants." As he's speaking, another servant comes and interrupts and says, "Lightning has struck and has burnt up all of the sheep and the servants." As he's speaking, another servant comes and says, "Three groups of Babylonians steal the camels and kill the servants." You don't want to be a servant in this story. And then a fourth servant comes and interrupts the third servant and says, "A great wind from the desert has come and destroyed the eldest son's home and has killed all of his children." Then, in the midst of shock and trauma and suffering, Job's body becomes covered from the top of his head to the soles of his feet with painful sores. And he sits in the ashes of his misery and sorts through finding broken pieces of pottery to offer his body relief. And three friends come to visit him to show their concern and comfort him. For 7 days and 7 nights, the friends sit on the ground with Job in silence because they saw how much he was suffering. What a beautiful ending. This would have been to the story. three friends, lifelong friends, gathering for 7 days and seven nights just to lay in the ash because they know their friend's suffering is beyond words. And the comfort that is received is only in their presence, that Job might know he is not alone. But in this comfort of the silence, Job begins to speak. And the rest of the story is Job speaking, his friends responding, the best that they know how to try and help their friend. And all of it has to do with the nature of God and Job's relationship to God. And his first friend says, please don't feel hopeless. You are blameless. And so surely things are going to turn around. And his second friend, it just goes downhill. His second friend decides to blame his dead children. Like, in what world would that be a good idea? And so that if Job would just turn to God in purity and righteousness, all of these things would change. And then his final friend, Zophar, with the coolest name ever, reassures Job that if he would just change and notice that even though Job's saying he's blameless, he must not be because God knows better, then he would have a secure and blessed future. What would you rather hear than when you're suffering? Then, well, God knows that you're bad, so just figure out what God's thinking and change it, and then you'll be all good. And so it's easy to kind of go down this road and be like, so far, you're just a jerk, shut up. And at the end of the book, just so you know, God kind of does do that. He like steps in and he's like, whoa, like we're going to call it a day. You guys are like way off track. I don't know what you're saying about me, but like Job actually is right. He's always been blameless. There is no other person on the earth like him. But his friends who had started spinning begin to shame him into changing so that his pain might be released and their own might be excused. We all have a Zophar in us, the part of us that even sits within our own mind and talks to ourselves when we are overwhelmed, when we don't know what to do. Snap out of it. It's not that bad. No one else is upset about this. Just pull it together. Why did you say anything? You look so stupid. Now everyone thinks you're dumb. All of those feelings, the Zophar that lives in our head, reminding us that you are not worthy of your suffering. Be quiet. Sit down. But Lent begins with Ash Wednesday. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this passage kind of whittled its way into our sermon series, that we confront Job sitting in his ashes, sorting through the dust of his life in complete mourning and pain. And three friends come along at the beginning of the story, throw dust on their heads, take off their shirts, and join Job in all of his suffering with silence, with solidarity. That this is the way Lent begins, with silence and solidarity, with mourning that is visible of our own mortality. But what happens between this beautiful moment and all of these horrible conversations that are trying to problem solve and help, and the moment that God, this resurrection moment, God just steps in and sets things right, what happens in this space between is that they no longer are willing to sit and stay in the messiness. And for 40 days, that's exactly what we're called to do, is not to drift away from trying with all of our might and all of our will and all of our intellect and all of our heart to insert the story of resurrection into the realities of our own lives. Because we have all had the messengers come into our lives at different times and give us news that turns us completely upside down and shakes us until we don't remember what day it is. A parent passes, an accident happens. On Wednesday, for us, it was Fiona's school was one among 14 schools that received a swatting call. And until Wednesday, I did not know what a swatting call was, or that 13 other schools were going through the same thing. All I knew was that my daughter had texted me she was on lockdown and it wasn't a drill. All that I knew is that her grandma was sitting outside of the school waiting to pick her up and was seeing SWAT teams enter the building, and I sat in my ashes. And I dusted myself off real quick, which is what Job's friends are trying to do to him, get him up and clean him up, because it can't be that bad. And if you just look at it a different way, this is the reality that we live in. It's just the way that things are. It's okay. It's just going to be this way. Let it go. And we can just dust ourselves off and clean ourselves off and move on. Easter is right down the road, right? And Job argues back every time. He curses his birth. He sticks up for God and he defends himself and his own pain. He is blameless and he is broken. And for me, I wonder what it would look like if our Lent was sitting in the ashes and sorting through the pieces of resurrection that are waiting for us. The promises of wholeness that are coming up and out of our lives every day in the presence of the people that love us and sit with us and never leave us. Who maybe say the wrong thing once in a while, but always come back to try again and say what is right. That perhaps a holy Lent isn't just about self-examination and repentance. It's not just about praying and fasting and self-denial or reading and meditating on God's holy word. Maybe the goal is to be more in touch, not just with spirituality in God, but with our pain in the ashes. That God is there too, calling us to be present to the realities that are unfolding right now. In all of the brokenness. And maybe like Job, we could confront Lent as real. That we are really wandering in this world in our own different ways, in our own different stories, delivered from our own different messengers. That these are not distant realities of a Jesus who suffered, but these are painful, tangible, heart-stopping, stomach-turning realities that linger over us every day. And that in this place of connection, it is on the periphery. It is in the dirtiness of the ashes, this place of exile and confusion and pain and helplessness, that the reality of God's indwelling is identified with human forsakenness. For where is God in all of this? And God is in this identity, in this helplessness, in this mourning, that they are intertwined is the message of Lent. That when we are wandering, God wanders within us. That when we are lost in wonder, God is surrounding us and grounding us once again in the anchor of a promise that we cannot understand. But still it is. As high as the heavens and as low as Sheol, it holds us in every way, in every moment. The cross is what speaks the truth of who we are, where we have been, and the possibility of a different future. God, against God, for God. Whether the Messiah comes, Ani Mamin, or is late in coming, Ani Mamin. Whether God is silent or weeps, Ani Mamin, I believe. Amen.